Today is September 18th, 2023. I want to talk about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, the ongoing Ukrainian offensive, and the increasing realization across the West that it is failing and that there really is no good option following the offensive. Building up the Ukrainian military for another offensive does not seem to be an option that they're even pretending to think about. Before I get into all of that, though, let's just take a look at the situation on the ground. This is via liveuamap.com. It is a pro-Ukrainian map, so keep that in mind while looking at it. And, as you can see, along the line of contact, for a major offensive ongoing, there's very little taking place. You see Ukrainian air defense claiming to shoot down all of these Russian missiles and drones. And we see here the main axis of attack. This map repeatedly over the last several days since my last update, that they have claimed that Ukraine has taken Verbove and Robotino multiple times, and then they show Russian counterattacks, and then they show Ukraine taking it back. So fighting is very much still ongoing. They're extending the map down here, claiming that, or at least suggesting, Ukrainian forces have pushed this far. There is no convincing evidence anywhere, even from pro-Ukrainian sources, that that is actually happening. Elsewhere, you see red rifle icons far beyond Russia's controlled territory, meaning that Russian forces are pushing forward into previously claimed Ukrainian territory. And in the Donbas region, it is the same. Russian forces on the offensive. Claims that Ukraine is taking over these tiny hamlets or single street villages or developments, but nothing substantial at all. And you have to remember, when looking at these supposed gains that the Western media is talking about, this is 3 full months of offensive operations going on to 4 months now. And this is all that they've managed to achieve when, and I have to remind people, the goal was, well, number one, they've been pretty adamant about taking back Bakhmut. They're nowhere near doing that. And as I pointed out, between Bakhmut and Poznia, there are layers of Russian defenses in between. They have not even broken through the front lines here to make it to those defensive lines. But I want to remind people that the goal of these two axes here, the goal is to reach the coast, the Sea of Azov. That is as far as they've gone, and they have exhausted their offensive potential in the process. All of their forces, all of these brigades that they stood up for the offensive, are already involved in the fighting. They have no additional troops to commit. They are actually bringing in units that they had that were never supposed to be involved in the offensive. They are involved because they are out of troops. They have exhausted their offensive potential, and this is where they are right now. What is the Western media saying about the offensive now at this moment, Monday, September 18th, 2023? This is from the BBC. War in Ukraine. Is the counteroffensive making progress? Here's some advice for people reading through Western headlines. When they ask a question like this, you don't need to read the rest of the article. The answer is no, they are not. Because if they were making any progress at all, that would be the headline. I can guarantee it. Especially when it's about a military force that the West fully backs. The article says, Ukraine's generals say they have broken through Russia's first line of defense in the south. We've assessed how far Ukrainian forces have really progressed and what signs there are of further breakthroughs along the front line. That is the BBC saying that they have assessed it. And let's go back to the article and check out the map. So here's the map. They have a little rectangle there highlighting the area where the fighting is taking place. This is 3 going on to 4 months of offensive operations. You literally cannot see what progress Ukraine has made on this map. So they have to zoom in about 50 times to show you the area of control they claim Ukraine has. limited Russian military control held or regained by Ukraine in purple, limited Russian military control in this red and white lines. So it's not a lot. It is not a lot for being this far in the offensive and having exhausted almost entirely Ukraine's offensive potential built up for this specific operation. They also continuously refer to this area that they are moving through. They are making progress through this area as slowly as they are. But this is actually the security zone. It is not technically a defensive line. You could call it a defensive line, but you have to qualify what that means in relation to the actual defensive lines that await Ukrainian forces once they make it through the security zone. The security zone is where Russia was mounting a mobile defense. There are fixed defensive positions, trenches, bunkers. There are things like that that have been built up in the security zone, but its primary purpose is to conduct a mobile defense against advancing Ukrainian forces, to fade when they're pushing in, to counterattack, to draw them in and destroy them, and continuously repeat the process for as long as possible. Many analysts, including myself, never imagined that Russia would continue this process in the security zone for three full months, and Ukraine would, at this point, not have even breached the first of the actual defensive lines. The BBC should make this distinction very clear. They are not, because the BBC is doing war propaganda, not analysis, not journalism. The BBC claims that they've verified sightings of Ukrainian troops beyond the main defensive lines. And there could be social media posts out there depicting actual Ukrainian forces that have somehow made it past the actual first defensive line. We remember weeks ago, a Ukrainian armored personnel carrier somehow ending up in one of these tank ditches. But a single APC or a small unit of infantry operating beyond the defensive line is not the same as actually breaching it. It's the same as Ukrainian forces landing on Crimea in these tiny groups that are very difficult to detect. But once they are detected, Russian forces annihilate them or drive them out. Have they reached Crimea? And the answer is no. This is the public relations stunts that Ukraine is good at. It's one of the only things they are actually capable of doing. But it is not the same as a breakthrough or Ukrainian forces actually reaching these positions. And then when we go back to liveuamap.com, a lot of this that they're showing as Ukrainian held or Russian lost territory is because of five Ukrainian soldiers seen in a drone walking in one of these areas. So they just extend the map because it's a pro-Ukrainian map. That's why I warn people. But even under the most optimistic analysis, that is still not, even if Ukrainian forces had reached that, it's at this point, it is not enough. The offensive is failing, in the process of completely failing. In the BBC article, they also have a section titled, "What is stopping Ukraine advancing faster?" Because people will notice that if they were supposed to be at the Sea of Azov, and this is as far as they've gotten, even if the BBC is trying to convince you that they're making progress, when you zoom out and you see that map, you realize not really. So the article says, Moscow saw this counterattack coming long ago and has spent months building the world's most formidable layered defenses in depth. This is what they look like from space: lines of interlocking obstacles, trenches, bunkers, and minefields, each covered by artillery. Its so-called dragon's teeth are concrete anti-tank barriers. I don't know why they say so-called. That's what militaries around the world call them. Vast minefields have slowed the Ukrainian advance. These minefields are intensely packed, in some places up to five mines laid in a square meter. And as other analysts like Mark Sloboda has pointed out, Russia has remote mine laying capabilities. They have newer, more advanced systems. They also have very old systems that are still more than capable of laying mines remotely, even behind advancing Ukrainian forces. So when their advance fails and they fall back, they end up running over mines they didn't even think were there, because when they came in, they weren't there. The BBC article continues, Ukraine's first attempt to charge through them in June quickly ended in failure, with its modern Western-supplied armor crippled and burning. Ukrainian infantry came similarly unstuck, taking horrific casualties. Kiev has since had to resort to clearing these mines on foot, often at night and sometimes under fire. Hence the slow progress to date. And one thing that they don't mention is the horrendous casualties that Ukraine sustains by doing this all with just infantry. But you can't see infantry in the same visible way that you can see a burning British Challenger 2 tank, for example. To make matters even worse for Ukraine is the fact that it appears Russian casualties have significantly dropped even in the middle of Ukraine's offensive. So this is Media Zona. This is a media project put together by US government-funded opposition figures from Russia. They no longer live in Russia. And they have been trying to keep track of Russian casualties. They claim 31,665 Russian casualties, corroborated by publicly available data as of the 8th of September, 2023. This is a much, much lower number than, say, the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense or General Staff put out. And this is something that Alexander Mikuris of the Duran pointed out. They have a graph down here, an interactive graph, and it shows you the confirmed, or at least deaths they claim they have confirmed from the start of the special military operation in February 2022 up to more recently, September 7th, September 8th, 2023. And as you can see, casualties were quite high in the beginning of the special military operation when Russian forces had entered Ukraine and basically went as deep into Ukraine as possible, often being surrounded by Ukrainian forces. Then it dropped, and then it spiked again during the fighting over Bakhmut. And ever since then, it has been reducing. It has been going down and down and down. And if you look at this period of time between June 4th, when the offensive began, up until now, you will see that this is one of the lowest periods, the lowest casualties in any period of that length throughout the conflict. There's one more period between June and August last year that is a little bit lower. So just keep in mind that Russian casualties are very low, even when the Western media is admitting Ukrainian casualties are catastrophically high. Then the BBC talk about these Ukrainian troops on foot trying to clear these minefields, and it says these will only be able to push forward in numbers once a sufficiently wide path has been cleared through the minefields and when Russian artillery there has been subdued. Once Russian artillery there has been subdued, which will never happen because there is just so much Russian artillery. Even if Ukraine somehow managed to destroy all of the artillery in that area, more artillery would simply come and replace it. They will not run out of artillery shells, at least not before Ukraine does. So what the BBC is indirectly telling you is that they will never be breaking through. They will be making this incremental progress until they run out of men and equipment. Then the article says, under a section titled, "What Next for Ukraine's Counteroffensive?" It says, Russia's forces are exhausted and possibly demoralized after sustaining 3 months of intensive attacks, including long-range strikes that are targeting their supply lines. What the BBC and many other Western media articles, and even Western military analysts, supposed experts, what they always do is fail to also mention that all of this that Russia is facing as part of this Ukrainian offensive, so is Ukraine, but just on a much larger scale. They're suffering more losses, more long-range attacks, not just attacks on their supply lines near the front, but attacks on their supply lines all the way up to the Polish border. So everything that they claim Russia is facing and may be wearing them down is also something Ukraine faces and is also wearing them down. Then the article says, if Ukraine can break through the remaining Russian defenses and reach as far as the town of Tokmak, which is not anywhere even near the original objective, which was the Sea of Azov. And let's just go to the map so people can see. This is where they're fighting right now. That right there is Tokmak. And you can see how far Tokmak is from the Sea of Azov, or even Melitopol. So if Ukraine can break through the remaining Russian defenses and reach as far as the town of Tokmak, then this would bring Russia's rail and road supply routes for Crimea within range of its artillery. If they can do that, then this counteroffensive can be judged as a qualified success. No, it cannot. And I'll explain in just a moment. Let's just finish reading what the BBC has to say. It may not end the war, which is likely to drag on well into 2024 and perhaps longer, but it would seriously undermine Moscow's war effort and put Ukraine in a strong position for when peace talks eventually begin. But for Kiev, the clock is ticking. The rainy season will arrive within weeks, turning the roads to mud and hindering further advances. There's also the problem of Ukraine simply running out of artillery shells. They will always be getting artillery shells from the United States and Europe, 155 millimeter artillery rounds. They may also always have a supply of 152 millimeter rounds for their Soviet era artillery, which is being manufactured in Eastern European countries at this moment, but it'll never be on the scale necessary to sustain combat operations such as an offensive or a very intense defense. Now here's the problem with them claiming if Ukraine even just makes it to Tokmak, it'll be a success because they will be in artillery range of Russian supply lines. Artillery can disrupt logistical lines. They can hit logistical lines, they can cause damage, but they cannot cut logistic lines. They cannot even sufficiently cut logistic lines to impact combat power in any very significant way. And we know this because Russian and Ukrainian forces were well within range of each other's logistical lines in the battle for Bakhmut, and yet both sides were able to resupply their forces sufficiently. The only problem that developed was when Russian forces were able to physically cut off and begin encircling Ukrainian forces. They would physically take a road that Ukrainian vehicles would under no circumstance ever be able to drive on at that point, from that point onward. Another circumstance is if you have air superiority over a particular supply route, you're able to patrol it, monitor it, and hit any convoy driving down it like Russia did in Syria. Unless you're able to do that, you're not able to sufficiently cut your enemy's supply lines, and they are able to adequately supply their forces. So between that and the idea that cutting the land bridge and then destroying the Crimean bridge is going to somehow isolate Crimea, the entire objective of this offensive is a flawed premise. The premise itself is flawed, and everything built on top of it is likewise flawed. And we're going to get into that in detail, both in terms of the training Ukraine received and also the military industrial output behind both the Ukrainian and Russian military. So actually, let's start talking about the Western media citing Western officials, analysts, military leaders about training. Let's start with training, and then we'll get into logistics last. Let's look at this article from The Guardian. This is an article Alexander Mikuris from the Duran pointed out to me. West must focus on preparing Ukraine's troops or we will all pay the price. This was actually published in July. A bureaucratic peacetime approach to training and stockpiling among Zelensky's allies is posing a threat to European security. Let's see what Jack Watling has to say. He is one of these military analysts in the West, and he says, for 2 months, Ukrainian forces have been endeavoring to fight their way through densely fortified Russian positions to breach the so-called Sorovikin line in an attempt to liberate their territory. Again, this is in July. Just keep that in mind. Fighting has been exceedingly hard, with heavy losses of equipment and personnel on both sides. Irrespective of how much progress is made over the coming months, Ukraine's international partners need to focus their assistance on preparing Ukrainian armed forces for the next fight, because at that point it was already abundantly clear that the offensive was failing and that this was not going to end the conflict. It's not even going to end favorably for Ukraine, this particular offensive. And so they're already thinking about what can we do for the next time and actually get it right. The article repeats this myth that Ukraine somehow had an artillery fire advantage over Russia. And I have repeatedly brought this up and explained how this cannot even, it doesn't even make sense. It's completely irrational. There is no actual evidence to suggest it exists. And even Ukrainian commanders have said that they are outgunned 10 to 1. So how does that somehow equate into an artillery advantage? And I think the reason why is because a lot of these analysts, and this is rooted in human nature, they don't want to watch videos of Russia destroying Ukrainian artillery with their drones, with their own artillery, their counter-battery radar, working together with multiple launch rocket systems, drones of all kinds, first-person view drones, Lancet drones, wiping out Ukrainian artillery and at a pace much greater than Ukraine was taking out Russian artillery. Ukraine was taking out Russian artillery, but just not on a scale that matches what Russia was inflicting on Ukraine, and not on a scale that impedes Russian combat power. And then Jack Watling provides a story about something he witnessed before the offensive was launched. And this is a story that Alexandra Mikuris brought up during a recent live stream on the Duran. And the article says a couple of months before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, so this was actually before the special military operation began, I was lying on a hilltop watching U.S. mechanized battalion thundering down a valley tasked with breaching a set of obstacles. The obstacles were less formidable than those in Ukraine, and the enemy in the exercise comprised a single company backed by limited artillery. So this is a battalion going up against a company. A battalion is larger than a company. Nevertheless, the U.S. troops made a mess of things. Their reconnaissance troops failed to screen their vehicles. They went static in sight of the enemy, and they were severely punished. The fact that well-trained U.S. troops struggle to conduct combined arms obstacle breaching under more favorable circumstances underscores how difficult it is. And then he says, what the Ukrainians would need in order to conduct successful offensive operations was clearly communicated to Western capitals from July to September last year, 2022. The priorities were artillery, engineering capability, tactical air defense, protected mobility, and collective and staff training. Of these, Ukraine's partners have provided sufficient artillery and protected mobility. No, they haven't, not even close. I don't even know how he drew that conclusion. Engineering and tactical air defense have been less forthcoming. Collective and staff training have been slow to be set up, with Ukraine's partners prioritizing training individual Ukrainian soldiers. Now, here's the problem with absolutely all of this. Ukraine was not given sufficient artillery. You're on the attack against heavily fortified defenses. You need more artillery than the defenders. And Ukraine doesn't have anywhere close to more artillery than Russia does. Not even close. Again, Ukrainian commanders admitting they're outgunned 10 to 1. So, I have no idea how that conclusion was drawn. Tactical air defense, this means air defense systems that are mobile, that you can bring with your forces to provide protection to your forces near the line of contact. So that would not be something like the Patriot or the Iris-T or the S-300 even. These would be very mobile systems like ASA, Pantsir, Buk, Tor, the US Avenger system, for example. Air defense systems like this, again, Ukraine's air defense capabilities Both fixed and mobile systems have been severely depleted, and the West has nowhere near enough to provide Ukraine as replacements. And then in terms of engineering equipment, this is to breach the minefields and as well as the obstacles if and ever they reach them in numbers. It doesn't matter how much of this engineering equipment the West provided Ukraine, they were going to be going into these minefields while under fire, and all of it was going to be destroyed. That was inevitable, and we know that because of the very nature of breaching minefields. You need to clear enemy forces beyond the minefield using your long-range fires before you try to clear the minefield itself, or you will come under fire and all of your equipment will be destroyed. That's why during Desert Storm, U.S. troops took advantage of their air superiority and their long-range fires, artillery, rockets, and missiles, and they wiped out Iraqi forces that were in range that could threaten engineering teams while they cleared paths through the minefields. They were also very well trained, training for years and years, these engineering units that breached these minefields, and they were able to quickly move through it. Occasionally, they did come under a small arms fire, but this engineering equipment is armored, and they were sufficiently armed to respond. And so that's why the U.S. succeeded in Iraq during Desert Storm, and why Ukraine failed during this most recent offensive. They had none of the above needed to actually breach the minefield. So all of the engineering equipment in the world would not have helped them unless they could create the conditions beyond the minefield that would allow them to work without coming under heavy fire. And then the training. This talk about training, and even in the article, they talk about 2 to 3 months of training for Ukrainian forces, some of these raw conscripts that have never served in the military before, thinking that that could be sped up, or thinking that if you just did more of that, it would be sufficient, illustrates a fundamental disconnect between these analysts and reality. I have explained this many, many times before. Entry-level infantrymen, tankers, artillerymen, it takes about 5 to 6 months, sometimes longer, just for them to get the basic skills as an individual soldier performing a task on the battlefield. Then they have to go to their unit, and then they train with their unit. Their unit trains with other units within their much larger organization, and they also have to train significantly to do combined arms operations to be effective at doing that. And to build up a unit capable of doing that on, say, the brigade level, which is what NATO was standing up for Ukraine, brigades, 4,000 men, it would take years to do that, and they're trying to do it in 2 or 3 months, which was disastrous. There's absolutely no way that you could possibly do this. And it has proven on the battlefield that it is impossible. You will send these men to their deaths. They will not achieve the objectives they are trying to achieve. Going back to these prerequisites that the article claims Ukraine needed for this offensive to be successful, they talk about artillery. They would actually need to have a real artillery advantage. That means more guns and more ammunition than Russia has, and they were never going to get that. The West has no way of providing Ukraine that. They would also need to have a significantly larger counter-battery capability. That means radar systems that can detect incoming Russian fire and track it back to its source to direct artillery and drones, rockets, missiles, air power onto that artillery position, and then all of the means to actually respond with counter-battery fire. They don't have anywhere near as much as Russia does. Even if they had all of the equipment and ammunition required, they don't have enough time to train Ukrainian troops. So let's go into the training just a little bit more. And I want to bring up this article written early last year, an article that the Wall Street Journal probably wishes they didn't write or that they could take back. And it's titled, "The Secret of Ukraine's Military Success, Years of NATO Training, Soldiers Plus Military Brass and Overseers in Parliament have been transformed from a rigid Soviet-style force into a modern army that thinks on the move. April 13th, 2022. Indeed, the US and the rest of NATO began training Ukrainian forces on a very large scale from 2014 onward. That means 8 years before the special military operation began, they created a force over the course of 8 years that has now been more or less wiped out. It does not exist, and that's even Western analysts admitting that. Michael Kaufman, who will be cited in another article that I'm about to go over, he has traveled to Ukraine several times over the course of this conflict, and he is the one who said that that force, for all intents and purposes, no longer exists. But this is what the Wall Street Journal was telling us in April of last year about the scale of the NATO training over those 8 years. So it says, through classes, drills, and exercises involving at least 10,000 troops annually, for more than 8 years, NATO and its members helped the embattled country shift from rigid Soviet-style command structures to Western standards, where soldiers are taught to think on the move. By the time Russia invaded on February 24th, training of Ukrainian forces had become so extensive that although at least 8 NATO countries participated, much of the hands-on training was being done by Ukrainian instructors. So they were teaching Ukrainians to teach other Ukrainians. To NATO commanders, that was a sign Ukraine had internalized their teachings. NATO introduced the idea of non-commissioned officers, which I will refer to as NCOs, experienced soldiers promoted to ranks of authority who serve as vital links between top brass and ground troops. NATO countries also helped Ukrainian military leaders adopt an approach called mission command, where higher ups set command goals and devolve decision making as far down as the chain of command as possible, even to individual soldiers. And then they talk about how in Russia that never happens, which I don't believe, I don't think is true. So in 8 years, tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers at all levels of the Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO for 8 years. And that force has been wiped out. And if you couldn't do that in 8 years, what do you think you're going to achieve in 2 or 3 months, or even 6 months, or even a whole year, if you spent a whole year preparing these troops now struggling and dying in this failed offensive? If you gave them a whole year's worth of training, would that have made any difference if 8 years wasn't even enough? I would say if 8 years wasn't enough, nothing they can do in the middle of this conflict will be enough. And I think that is self-explanatory. I think we see the reality on the ground proving that. Let's look at another article here from Financial Times. I saw Alex Cristoforo of the Duran going over this. The hard lessons from Ukraine's summer offensive. The country's military is enjoying some success, but it will be slow going and require allies to increase ammunition supply. So I'm going to start talking about military industrial output. You can see this map in the background at the top of this article, and these little tiny yellow blotches that you could barely see. That is the progress, that's the success that the Financial Times claims Ukraine is somehow having. This is how the article begins. Yes, people tend to want results immediately. This is understandable, President Vladimir Zelensky told a conference in Kiev last weekend, speaking about Ukraine's summer offensive. But this is not like a feature movie where everything happens in an hour and a half. The offensive literally had a movie trailer. The Ukrainian armed forces made a movie trailer style video to promote the upcoming offensive, which typically is something you try to keep as secret as possible, but Ukraine had been talking about it along with their Western sponsors months and months ahead of time, which is what gave Russia months and months to prepare unprecedented defenses ahead of it. The idea that Ukrainian forces lacking any air cover would storm through Russian lines was always going to be more of a Hollywood plotline than reality. But 3 months into the counteroffensive, Zelensky and his government are dealing with the reality that it has not achieved the desired decisive breakthrough and are girding themselves for a drawn-out war. And that's interesting that they say lacking any air cover, storming through Russian lines was unthinkable, because everyone in the West, from politicians to military leaders to military analysts, again, across the entirety of the media, they said it would be a success. It would be easy. These Challenger 2 tanks were just going to push Russian forces right off the battlefield. We just read a BBC article where they're still trying to convince us that the offensive is viable and that it could still succeed. I just read to you from the BBC trying to convince readers of that. So this Financial Times article continues. It says, Ukraine's armed forces have made slow but significant gains in the south of the country in recent weeks. I showed you those yellow blotches. You could decide for yourself if you think that's significant, including a first puncture in Russia's formidable defensive line. And I've already gone over how that is the security zone that is not the first of Russia's formidable defensive lines, plural, because they have multiple lines and they're layered. But some officials in Western capitals regret that Kiev has failed to use the opportunity afforded by Western weapon stockpiles and possibly peak political support. So here's the article already contradicting itself. It just said that it was unthinkable without air cover that this offensive could have succeeded. And now they're claiming that some in Western capitals are disappointed that Ukraine didn't take better advantage of the capabilities given to them that the article admits did not give them the ability to make a breakthrough. It continues. Some U.S. officials have complained privately to the media that Ukraine had failed during training to master modern operations that combine mechanized infantry, artillery, and air defense, and were too risk adverse in their approach. This is the U.S. blaming Ukrainians, often raw conscripts with no military background, for failing to become efficient combined arms soldiers in just 2 or 3 months, when basic training in the U.S. for a soldier or a Marine is around 2 or 3 months. It takes 5 months for a U.S. Marine infantryman to finish their basic and infantry training. 5 months. So 2 or 3 months to not only teach them how to be infantry soldiers, but how to work as part of a unit, as part of a group of units, applying combined arms warfare. That is unrealistic. It's fantastical. The people blaming Ukraine for not being able to, in 2 or 3 months, pull this off are arguing in bad faith. And it's not surprising what the article says next then. It says, Ukrainian officials, meanwhile, have pointed out that American forces have themselves never conducted operations on battlefields like Ukraine's without air superiority against a military the size and caliber of Russia's and against some of its most advanced weaponry and military technologies. And just remember, they're now admitting how formidable the Russian military is after telling us for over a year and a half that they were walking barefoot into Ukrainian lines swinging shovels. Now, finally, the truth is coming out. The article continues. It says, and they're quoting a Ukrainian artillery battery commander, and it says, show us at least one officer or sergeant in the American Army who has fired, for example, 5,000 to 7,000 rounds with their M777 howitzer. Which is true, as we've pointed out. As it was announced that the U.S. was to send M777 howitzers to Ukraine, we pointed out how its light construction was meant to have it easily transported from mountaintop to mountaintop in Afghanistan to different fire bases where they would set them up and they would just sit there and they would fire a few rounds every day to support patrols out in the field. They didn't have to worry about counter-battery fire because the Taliban didn't have systems capable of striking back at the M777. How sending a weapon designed for that type of combat onto the battlefield in Ukraine, where it would go up against heavy Russian artillery fire, rocket fire, missile fire, military aviation, was going to be catastrophic, a catastrophic failure. And it has been. And all of this criticism from Ukraine is fair. because they were put in an impossible position. And now, hopefully, some of them are waking up to the reality that they were proxies that Washington, Brussels, and London were using, proxies that were entirely disposable, proxies that were forced to fight under conditions the U.S. would never allow its own troops to fight under. Hopefully that realization is emerging in Ukraine. Then the article says, after early unsustainable losses, Ukraine has pivoted back to a campaign of attrition, wearing down the enemy at the front with artillery and destroying supply lines with long-range strikes, while using small infantry assaults to retake Russian positions. While some in NATO worry this attritional approach sounds like the old Soviet mindset taking hold, Ukrainian officials and Western analysts who have studied this summer's fighting say it is more adapted to conditions on the ground, including Russia's heavy fortifications and dense minefields, Ukraine's lack of air power, and the prevalence of drones exposing everything on the battlefield. And this is the article quoting Michael Kaufman and also Rob Lee, that article that I've previously gone over in my last update on the Ukrainian conflict. If you are suffering from weapons and ammunition shortages and a lack of trained manpower, and you decide to pivot to attritional fighting against an enemy force larger than yours with much more artillery and ammunition, more vehicles, military aviation, that is a clear step toward defeat. There's no way that you are going to succeed. You're not going to wear down a much larger and better supplied enemy. That is common sense. It's logic. That seems to be escaping the people proposing this idea of Ukraine fighting an attritional war against Russia. The Financial Times article repeats the claims made by the BBC that somehow maybe Ukraine can still reach Tokmak, and if they can reach Tokmak, maybe that would be a success of some kind. And again, they're forgetting to mention that Ukraine has already committed all of the brigades that it had set aside for this offensive. They have nothing left to exploit any breakthrough in any meaningful way. And even if they were able to make a breakthrough and exploit it, they would have no troops left to weather the inevitable counterattack by Russian forces. This is something we already see playing out daily, even on the pro-Ukrainian map, live map. Then the article throws in the prospect of a few more wonder weapons arriving. They talk about ATACMS. They talk about Germany's air-launched Taurus cruise missile, just similar to the Storm Shadow and Scalp Ukraine is already using, which is already failing to change the tide or change the game. And then the article says, ultimately, the course of the war will be decided by how each side manages its reserves of manpower and equipment. And that is actually something Michael Kaufman said. They didn't quote him. They just wrote it as if they thought about this themselves. And then it says, our big problem is sustainability, says a Ukrainian official. It is a war of resources. Ukraine and Russia are in a slugging match where neither side has a decisive advantage. That is not true. We'll go over that in just a moment. It's going to be a long war, and Ukraine is now in the messy middle part that happens in every major conflict, says one senior Western official. Militaries very rarely deliver decisive outcomes. They win battles, the official adds. In attritional conflicts such as this one, it's economies that win wars. Well, if that's true, then maybe we should look at economies. And the most relevant aspect of an economy, its military-industrial outputs. Which brings me to this New York Times article that I've talked about in several recent interviews on other channels, but I've not gone over it on my own channel yet. This is from the New York Times. Russia overcomes sanctions to expand missile production, officials say. Moscow's missile production now exceeds pre-war levels, officials say, leaving Ukraine especially vulnerable this coming winter. The article says Russia's re-energized military production is especially worrisome because Moscow has used artillery to pound Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines and its missiles to attack the electric grid and other critical infrastructure and to terrorize civilians in cities. Officials fear that increased missile stocks could mean an especially dark and cold winter for Ukrainian citizens. In the meantime, the Pentagon is working to find ways to help Ukrainians better take down the missiles and drones fired by Russia at civilian targets in Kiev and military targets around the country. The Pentagon has provided Patriot air defense systems and cajoled allies to provide S-300 air defense ammunition, both of which have proven effective. Have they? According to who? What evidence do they present that that is true? And the answer is, in this article, none. They provided no evidence of that. It has also provided other air defenses, like the Avenger system and the Hawk air defense system. Except, all of this is all old news. The Patriot missile system, the Avenger, the Hawk missile system, all of these were already announced many, many months ago. The Patriot missile system went to Ukraine while already suffering from a very critical missile shortage. That's because Saudi Arabia had been using the Patriot missile system in its conflict against Yemen. It was using these missiles very unsuccessfully, it should be mentioned, to intercept drones coming from Yemen and also rockets and missiles. By the time it reached Ukraine, there were not nearly enough Patriot missiles to supply Ukraine sufficiently for the amount of incoming Russian missiles and drones that Ukraine faced. Production of the Patriot missile interceptors is not nearly high enough to sustain the rate of fire Ukraine would need to sustain to be successful with the Patriot missile system, if it was even efficient and effective. They don't even have enough missiles to do this. The Avenger is basically a vehicle-mounted Stinger missile system. The U.S. is out of Stinger missiles. They sent huge quantities to Ukraine at the beginning of the conflict. They don't have the ability to manufacture these fast enough to keep up with the rate of fire that Ukraine has been using them with. And the capability of the Stinger missile as part of the Avenger system is simply, the range is simply too short to intercept Russian military aviation along the line of contact, especially when using glide bombs. And then the Hawk air defense system, also mentioned in this article, it's antiquated. It's already been out of service for, I think, almost 20 years. Has not been used by the U.S. for over 20 years. They have to refurbish them and then send them to Ukraine. Not because they're effective, not because it is a good option that suits Ukraine, but because it is literally the only thing the U.S. has left to send Ukraine. Then the New York Times admits, it says, but Ukraine does not have enough air defense systems to cover the entire country and must pick the sites it defends. An increased barrage of missiles could overwhelm the country's air defenses, Ukrainian officials said. It could. It already has. It has repeatedly. And all of this is if what the New York Times says about Ukraine intercepting Russian missiles and drones successfully, if that's even true. It most likely isn't true. They don't produce any evidence at all that suggests that it's true. They're most likely citing Ukrainian Ministry of Defense or General Staff numbers, and we know that those are the same sources that led many people to believe that the Russian military was depleted and that Ukrainian forces were just going to roll over Russian defenses when the offensive began. Then the New York Times starts talking about other weapon systems Russia is manufacturing in larger and larger quantities. It says, before the war, one senior Western defense official said Russia could make 100 tanks a year. Now they say they are producing 200. Western officials also believe Russia is on track to manufacture 2 million artillery shells a year, double the amount Western intelligence services had initially estimated Russia could manufacture before the war. Now, the number of tanks that Russia makes every year is a number that I already saw in pro-Western media, and they cited 250 new tanks every single year. And that was before the special military operation began. So that I don't know where they're getting this 100 tanks a year number. It was 250 new tanks a year and 600 modernized tanks. So they would take an older T-72 or an older T-90 tank, and they would upgrade it to the latest standards, the latest fire control, thermal sights, armor protection, perhaps putting in a new, more efficient engine. And so that's well over 800 tanks a year before the special military operation began. Surely they have increased production, no matter which number you believe. What the New York Times is telling you is that the Russian military, its combat power is growing, while Ukraine's combat power is shrinking. Then the New York Times says, as a result of the push, Russia is now producing more ammunition than the United States and Europe. And this confirms what I have been saying for many months now, that Russia right now produces more artillery shells than the US and Europe will be producing years to come when they finally, if and when they finally expand production of artillery ammunition. Then it says, Russia's current ammunition production is 7 times greater than that of the West. Russia's production costs are also far lower than the West, in part because Moscow is sacrificing safety and quality in its effort to build weapons more cheaply. Partly. I'll tell you what the other part is in just a moment. For instance, it costs a Western country $5,000 to $6,000 to make one 155-millimeter artillery round. That is astounding. Whereas it costs Russia about $600 to produce a comparable 152-millimeter artillery shell, he said. One of these officials that they're citing said. It really doesn't matter why it's cheaper, it just is. It's cheaper and it's being done in greater quantities. A much more realistic explanation as to why it's cheaper in Russia than it is in the West is because the Western military industrial complex is immensely corrupt. It is incredibly corrupt. There is no meaningful oversight reigning in this corruption, and these corporations, not only do they fund these think tanks where consensus is reached regarding U.S. foreign policy, but they have a massive lobbying arm that influences legislators in Washington directly. The Western military-industrial complex is first and foremost profit-driven. They don't care about making the most weapons, the most effective weapons, the largest amount of weapons as cheaply as possible. All they care about is maximizing profits, even if it, in the long run, impacts national security. And it is that reality that the West's military-industrial complex dictates foreign policy to Washington rather than the other way around. That reality is why the West is in the situation it is in right now, being outproduced collectively by Russia alone. And it's because of this reality that the West cannot fix this problem, because it is deeply systemic. This is something that they would have to have the political will and also the capability of changing. They have neither. And even if they had both, it would take years and years to reform the system that has created this problem in the first place. Then the article talks about how Russia ramping up military industrial output is hurting the Russian economy. It never mentions the economic problems the US and Europe right now face because of their sanctions and the conduct of this proxy war in Ukraine against Russia. It never talks about that. Another problem the New York Times complains about is how other nations around the globe are not interested in helping isolate and undermine Russia economically, or more specifically in terms of military industrial production. And this is why I often tell people who complain about Russia not being more forceful regarding the special military operation, not going in harder, faster, bigger, stronger, more destructive. People who complain about Russia not exacting immediate revenge after all of these attacks that the West helps facilitate Ukraine in conducting, say at the airfields across Russia, at the port in Crimea, the Crimean Bridge. The reason why Russia maintains infinite patience regarding this is because it knows that if it were to react to exact immediate revenge against either Ukraine or, say, the UK or the US enabling Ukraine, this would undermine its support globally, which is what is allowing it to circumvent US sanctions and maintain this fundamental advantage in military industrial output. This fundamental factor that is going to allow Russia to win in this proxy war the US is waging against it in Ukraine. Now, these are things that I have been saying for over a year and a half. These are things other analysts have been saying for a very, very long time. Anyone following my work or their work are not going to be hearing anything new in this video about what I just talked about. The important thing to point out, though, is that it is the New York Times finally reporting this. It is the West coming to grips with the reality of what is happening in Ukraine and the implications it has, whether the New York Times wants to acknowledge them or not, the implications this has geopolitically around the rest of the globe for the United States and its European allies. The New York Times is finally admitting this elsewhere across the Western media, and because they're citing Western officials and analysts, they're admitting that this is a problem. But even at the end of the New York Times article, they still try to spin it as if things can be turned around. All they have to do is send more air defense to Ukraine to counter the increase in Russian missile production, when in reality, they have no more air defense capabilities to transfer to Ukraine, and that it goes far beyond just missile production. They also talked about artillery shell production being many times larger than the collective West's production numbers. So what are they going to do about that? They never even addressed how they were going to solve that, because they cannot solve it. The recommendations that I'm hearing from these analysts who are now admitting that this is a major problem, if not the central problem, they're saying expand the military-industrial output of the West. But it takes years to do that. And it's not just expanding military-industrial output alone. There are fundamentals for military-industrial output that need to be addressed, such as infrastructure or education or where you're obtaining the raw materials for this production. And all of these in and of themselves have very long lead times when attempting to address them. So this is a huge problem that the West cannot and most likely will not even try to fix or solve. This is something that the US is beginning to realize is a problem regarding Russia in Ukraine, while still at the same time trying to provoke war with China, which has an even larger industrial base than Russia does. Never mind the fact that China and Russia are cooperating in many ways, enhancing their respective military-industrial capabilities. And what it seems like is the West, the United States, Washington, Wall Street, London, Brussels, what they're hoping is that they can threaten Russia and China with enough chaos to convince them to stop, to come to the negotiation table. And they're hoping that neither one of them recognize or utilize this massive advantage they have in terms of military-industrial power. Russia is already using it to their advantage. I have no doubts that if pushed, China will as well. One thing that I can almost guarantee will not happen is Moscow or Beijing negotiating away their future, their sovereignty, their prospects, rather than utilizing this military power that they have that the West does not. So I will conclude there. If you thought this video was useful, please like and share. Think about subscribing. It's free to do and it helps the channel grow. Check the video description below for other places you can find and follow my work. Telegram, for example, is where I post absolutely everything, including full videos. I post them there as a backup for YouTube, Rumble, Odyssey. I also post articles there that I've written, as well as just thoughts for the day. I'm also on Twitter, but I primarily post everything on Telegram, and then it filters over to my other platforms. Also in the video description below are ways you can help support my work. I do not monetize my YouTube channel. If an ad pops up, feel free to skip it because it isn't helping me out at all. If you do want to help support my work, please do so through Buy Me a Coffee and also Patreon. To everyone who has been helping out, whether it's a one-time donation, donations month to month, or even if you're just helping share my work with others, all of that help is greatly appreciated. That is what makes this work possible. So thank you, and as always, thank you for watching.